I don't think there's a more fragmented, nuanced, complicated sports fan base in the entire world than soccer in America.
Major League Soccer is catching up to the NHL.
They have the second highest total attendance of any soccer league throughout the globe.
The league has grown dramatically.
Big audience, big influence, millions of followers. If we've got one thing right, I think it's our positioning, which is really leaning into being the soccer specialists, the soccer experts who can navigate the space in this country.
If you have advice for both creators and brands who want to work with them on how to achieve really successful partnerships.
That's a big old question, Francis. What a way to start.
Well, welcome back to the Creator Spotlight podcast. Today, we are speaking with Kyle Sheldon, the founder and CEO of Name and Number, a soccer-specific marketing and creative agency founded in 2022. Kyle has also been working in and around soccer for two decades, including head of marketing roles at three major league soccer clubs, DC, Seattle, and Chicago. So we are going to have a lot to talk about.
It's great to be here, Francis. Thank you for having me.
Yes, of course. Okay, we should start with your career history. So like I said, you've been working in soccer for two decades, minus a three-year stint at NASCAR. You started at DC United as a comms coordinator 20 years ago this year. And at that time, too, MLS had only been around for a decade. So this is maybe a bit too broad of a question, too wide, but I would love to hear how you've seen the sports marketing, and I guess specifically the soccer marketing world, change over the last 20 years as the technology has changed and as the sport has developed in this country?
That's a big old question, Francis. What a way to start.
Break it down into chapters, maybe.
Yeah, you know, I'm fortunate. I mean, the sort of very quick background is lifelong soccer player and fan. I've loved the sport since I was a kid. Three siblings, we all played. I played very poorly in college. I was a D3 bench warmer. That's not false modesty. But I've always loved the sport, and I felt very fortunate to start my kind of official career at DC United in 2005. Mm-hmm. For those that know soccer a little bit, you'll remember the Freddie Adu era, the 14-year-old who at the time was the youngest player ever signed in American professional sports. And, you know, I'm 44 years old. I graduated college in 2003. So I've had this really I feel like I'm one of those – I'm in that generation where I was still faxing box scores when I started my career. Maybe a little before 2005, but even as an intern in 2003 and 2004. So I've seen the full gamut. And so truly there are chapters to the sport as well as how you communicate and how you reach an audience. So I feel really fortunate to be in a position where I feel like I've kind of seen it all from fully analog and non-digital and making phone calls and sending faxes to obviously now the fragmented space we're in. So happy to go deeper on any of that, but
yeah.
It's been an interesting journey.
So you started in comms, and then I think around 20, maybe earlier, but by around 2010, you were kind of the head of marketing role for DC United. And then those are the roles you've held ever since, except for at NASCAR, you had a more focused role on social media. And then now running your own agency, obviously you're back to a more broad purview. But so you've been kind of at the higher strategic level on all your marketing work since around 2010, right?
It maybe looks that way, Francis. I would say the whole way through when you're working in MLS, it's still very much, you know, while it's grown a ton, right? And just I'll give it just a little bit of context. When I came into DC United, entry-level communications coordinator, making no money, writing press releases, doing the media guide, they were going from 10 teams to 12 teams in MLS at that time.
Now it's 30.
So it's grown significantly. And so, you know, I think even today, if you're in a head of marketing role at a club, as I have been over my last couple stops, is you're still in it. You're still doing the work in a lot of cases. Certainly, you know, I've managed teams of 20, 25 at MLS clubs. And I love the work. So it's not a complaint, but there's sort of an element of it's strategic combined with, you know, digging into the details as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not the coach. You're a player coach.
that's a good way to think about it. And now, you know, running my own shop, I've been able to grow from just myself to now six full-time people, but you're still in it. So I love all of it. I love the strategic part. I love the doing. I love the work. I love the relationship building. You know, there's value in all of it.
We should talk about why you launched Name and Number when you did, which is your agency. And then maybe a little after that, we'll get into the newsletter, which I'm sure some people would love to hear about. But I see it as basically two things. My guess, you can tell me if I'm right.
Yeah.
One is you launched it, I think, 2.5 years ago. So you're at the start of your 40s. You've been in this industry, in this career for 20 years, kind of time to start your own thing, own your own thing, invest in your future. But it's also, when you launch it, it's, you know, it, Messi hasn't come to the U.S. yet. That's something that is big for the industry. But the CONCACAF.
Do you mean the World Cup?
The Copa America.
Copa America. Yeah. There's so many tournaments. It's hard to keep track.
Let alone the League Cup, etc. But all that to say is there's these three major tournaments coming to the country. And, you know, much ink has been spilled, much podcast hours have been spilled, et cetera, broadcast hours about the growth of the industry in this country. You sent me over a deck about your creator initiative, which we'll get into in a little bit. But I think you're referring to name and number. You refer to it as being the number 10 of American soccer.
Yeah.
So it's clear to me that you're positioning this agency and yourself to be this driving force in growing the sport and marketing the sport in this country.
Yeah.
Tell me more about why you started it.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I'm a lifelong player and fan, so I've always had a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit. I was homeschooled growing up, as were my three siblings, so we were really encouraged to chase the things we were interested in, and there was a kind of curiosity built into our education in a way that I think has served me pretty well over the course of my career. You know, the timing was to your point, it's just sort of looking at the landscape and what's coming. At that time, I launched November 1st of 2022, which was the month the 2022 World Cup started in Qatar. Really intentionally done, of course. And you know, I kind of looked at the broader soccer landscape here in the country, and there really weren't, and still sort of aren't, that many soccer specific and soccer only agencies. There's only a handful. There are certainly big sports marketing agencies that do great work in soccer, but I felt there was room for someone who understands the nuance of the sport in this country. And obviously, you and I were talking a little bit before jumping on and recording, as a kind of late to life Arsenal fan, you know, you sort of understand there's a lot of pathways, no pun intended, into the sport and the nuance that exists in the States. I tell people, I don't think there's a more fragmented, nuanced, complicated sports fan base in the entire world than soccer in America. It's a very strange place that I love. But really all of that background and then seeing the growth up close, right? And seeing the trajectory of not only MLS, but English Premier League viewership and the broadcast rights that were being sold at massive numbers, the number of tournaments that are coming here, the number of friendlies that are being played in our country, the number of players that are being signed and being both imported and exported, like every metric is just on an upward trajectory. And so it seemed like a good time to take a run at it. But as with anything, I feel like you jump into it not knowing what the response is going to be. And we've been fortunate that really from the first month or two, we've been receiving calls because if we've got one thing right, I think it's our positioning, which is really leaning into being the soccer specialist, the soccer experts who can navigate the space in this country.
And you've got clients from American clubs, European clubs, what is it, like a fourth division Irish club or something like that?
Yeah.
You've got people from all over the world working with you to reach American audiences.
Yeah, the very first person to reach out to me was the owner of the fifth division Scottish club. You were really close, Francis. The fifth division Scottish club, who wanted to raise money as part of a fan ownership push.
Yeah.
And so we took that project on for, you know, very little money. It was the first project, but we were excited to do it. Took on everything, positioning, campaign, social content, video production. We flew over to Glasgow and created a couple of videos and documentary. And they've now raised over the last 2 years, almost $3 million in fan ownership for a fifth division Scottish club. So the sport really kind of knows no bounds. And it's a great example because it speaks to people's desire to be connected to the sport. I think soccer has, all sports do this to an extent, but I think soccer in particular, it speaks to kind of this global nature, and Americans in particular love the European version of the game. They love promotion relegation. They love the idea that a small club outside of Glasgow, Scotland, could eventually, you know, rise up multiple tiers and play against Celtic or Rangers.
Very American dream.
It is, right?
All the more ironic that we don't have that system here.
That's another podcast, I think, Francis.
Yeah, it certainly is. Okay, we should talk about Pathway as well, which you launched 1 year after launching Name and Number. And Name and Number, you founded as a solo founder. You're the founder and CEO. Pathway is you, your brother, Nolan, and formerly another guy, John Bayo. The mission stated is to help ambitious people break into and build careers in soccer. I know it as a newsletter. Is it more than the newsletter? What is Pathway? Hey, if you're enjoying this episode, make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss next week's episode. We release a new one every Thursday. Enjoy.
It's primarily the newsletter at this stage of its life cycle. When we launched with the three of us, you know, we jumped into it a little bit, not knowing kind of what the full business model would be. I would say for myself, I think I've thought of it as a little bit of a side hustle. Fortunately, Name and Number has taken up a ton of time and energy, and we've been growing rapidly. So, you know, Nolan, my brother, who you mentioned, he spent his entire career on the technical side of the sport, assistant coach at DC United and then Austin FC, really knows the on-the-field part of the game in a way that few do in this country. And then John Bale, who you mentioned, similarly, on the technical side, was a scout for the U.S. men's national team, was actually at the World Cup in Qatar with the men's national team. And the three of us came together with the idea of how do we help people, kind of grow, break into, but then grow and build their careers. We all have a little bit of a heart for mentorship. We've all, you know, hired and grown people's careers. So there's a starting point there of, you know, wanting
That's
to help people.
It's a bit of a give back type of.
A little bit. I mean, you know, not to be overly, you know, sort of overly clear-hearted on it. I mean, you know, we thought there was a business there as well,
yes.
Right? And we still think there is. But we as a group, I think, really got energy and, you know, it felt good to try and help people navigate a space that we knew really well, but that others didn't. And the number of calls I've received over my career, just for people trying to figure it out, right? It's a difficult landscape. Any industry, I think, is. And soccer, as I said earlier, is very nuanced. So, I'd say long way of saying is we tested a bunch of things last year when we had the three of us. We were doing some recruiting. We did some hiring. But you know, the newsletter was a starting point, and really we thought of it as one of the ways we wanted to build a community of people who love the sport and are interested in working and kind of growing their careers. As John, we're really thrilled for him. He got a top assistant job at Nashville SC. It was a really cool opportunity to go work with one of his former colleagues at the U.S. men's national team, BJ Callahan. And so, that left Nolan and I to figure it out. So we took a little bit of a break and we've just brought it back this year. And we've really just honed the focus on the newsletter and just, you know, really trying to bring people into the soccer industry. So we interview what we call soccer thought leaders, just people who are kind of movers and shakers in the sport. There's always a thread woven through it of like, how do you find your way in? How do you open the door to a potential career if that's something you want to do? So it's been really fun. It's been really rewarding. I feel like it's one of those things. And those of us who are entrepreneurs, I feel like have, you know, a list of 15 of these things where if I dedicated all my time to it and really got after it, I feel like it could be significant. But you know, I'm prioritizing name and number with Pathway as a fun kind of stretch your brain in a different way project.
Yeah. So I'll describe the newsletter quickly for anybody who hasn't seen it or read it. It's pretty substantial. I would say it's also like a pretty classical like industry newsletter format. Like it feels like something I could receive in the mail and look forward to every month. So there's like a brief intro note from you or your brother. A full-length interview with one of these soccer thought leaders you mentioned. Usually it's quite long. It's usually around like 1,500 words. Industry job listings, anywhere from like 5 to 12, and then a few links around the web. So I know the monetization side, you know, speaking of not being so clear-hearted on it, I know that you, at least in the past, have sold inclusion in the jobs list, a featured job promotion, or a featured sponsor slot. Are you still monetizing like this, or are there other ways you're doing it?
We haven't been, you know, and I would say as we've come back this year, you know, we tested a lot of things last year, some of which worked really well and some of which didn't. You know, we're still modest. I mean, in terms of size, you know, we're 4,000 subscribers, but it's a really engaged audience. Our open rates are around 75-80%. So people are very tuned in, those that are there, but it's all been organic. We haven't really done any paid promotion behind it. And on the monetization side, we've sort of agreed for this year, it's really about trying to just build and grow the newsletter. I think about it differently than maybe, I don't know if we can say this for newsletters yet since they've had a bit of a resurgence the last several years, but it's different than the traditional model. Is for me, it's a feeder for name and number. It's a feeder for new business, right?
Is what I thought.
One, you're obviously talking to soccer thought leaders, people who are influential in the sport, many of whom I've either worked with in the past or had some relationship with in the past, but often new folks that I haven't connected to. And I think, you know, having listened to several of your interviews, you know, is just being active, being present, showing up kind of again and again really does bear fruit over time. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be a point, I think, where we'll focus more on the monetization of the newsletter itself. But for the moment, it's continue to grow, you know, continue to try and build the community and look at it as another opportunity to connect into the soccer community that's here in the States.
Yeah. Well, it's consolidating your position as a thought leader and as a connector and as the number 10 of American soccer, maybe not you specifically, but name a number, however you want to put that. But that was kind of my impression is that, yeah, it's nice to sell ads, sell job listings, whatever. But really, this is about like you being this connector and knowing people and meeting people. And like you said, I kind of looking at it, I was thinking this is not a product that you could have launched 15 years ago. Like, one, newsletters weren't the same thing they are today. But I mean, 15 years earlier in your career, because you wouldn't have met all these people. You wouldn't have been able to convince them to interview. Maybe you would have, but it would have been much harder.
No, totally agree. And I think, how Pathway started was an extension of what was happening just over the course of my career, is having been in the sport, having had connections and relationships over, 15 plus years at that time. People were asking me for this information, right? They were asking to be connected. They were asking for introductions. They were saying, how do I do this? And so it just felt like a really natural transition. I'd say the other thing is I sort of got into the habit of sharing open jobs in soccer across, at the time, Twitter, now X. And just as a simple, I guess, a service in some ways, but it was really just aggregating them, because I knew where to find them. I also knew how to give some context on the opportunity. And so, if you look back through my Twitter history, it's these threads of all the open jobs at different points in soccer. And so that naturally, I think, led people to ask me, how do I do this, or who can you introduce me to? And so to that extent, Pathway was sort of a natural extension of that.
Much easier to, instead of telling everybody, 10 times a week, to just be, hey, read the newsletter, which you have like 14,000 followers on X, on Twitter, whatever you want to call it. Is that largely like a result of you being this resource over the years, or how did you build up that audience?
Yeah, I think, well, I would say it accelerated a little bit. I mean, I'm not, it's not a massive audience, but it's the right niche audience. And it's true on LinkedIn as well. I was an early adopter of Twitter and X. When you work for a pro soccer team in America, you look for any opportunity to connect to fans, right? Traditional media coverage was hard when I started my career. It's, trying to get NBC4 in Washington, D.C. to come out and cover D.C. United when you have the, formerly the Redskins and the Nationals who just come to town, and, the Wizards, et cetera. So Twitter was sort of a natural way to try and tell our story. So I was early on the platform and really enjoyed it. I think I get a lot of energy out of connecting with fans who love the sport that I love. As I started to share the jobs, people just started click and follow more often. So, I think it's a natural extension, and it's maybe worth just saying that my presence across those social channels have led to the bulk of the business that have come in through Name and Number. Almost everything we've secured over the last now 2.5 years has been inbound, which has, it's good and bad in many ways, but, you'd rather have more coming in than not.
Well, and especially it being organic and that you haven't paid for any growth on the newsletter, which is something I do want to ask about, like the potential size of that audience for the newsletter, which is related right to the size of the soccer industry in this country, which I was looking for numbers before this. I couldn't find anything good. Everything I found was like, oh, there are millions of people working in the soccer industry in this country, which I'm like, maybe that doesn't sound quite right. That's probably including people who are like volunteering for their kids' team as a coach, whatever it is. But I'm curious what you know about the size of the industry in terms of how many people are working in it and how many people you could reach with the newsletter.
That's really interesting, Francis. I don't know that there is data on how many people are working in the industry. And as we sort of established, I mean, it's because it's so fragmented and nuanced, there's a lot of different ways to count it.
Well, right? Just MLS, how many people on average do you think work for any MLS team on the, off the field? Times 30.
Yeah, I'd say that number is between 80 and 150, depending on the club and the market, right? Yeah. So, round numbers, 3 to 5,000, maybe a little bit more across MLS, NWSL, smaller teams, generally speaking. So I don't see that though as the audience necessarily. No. It's
well,
a portion of the audience,
all
right?
Working in
right. But although you'd be, I think I was a little bit surprised at how many folks in the industry have followed and clicked subscribe on Pathway. We've done a few surveys, and the split has surprised me a little bit. And it's about a third of people who are early in their career and want to break into the industry, about a third who are kind of middle career and either in the industry or looking to, we kind of call it a career pivot, someone who wants to break into the soccer industry, but is in a different space. And then about a third are kind of senior executives, right? 15 plus years. And that split surprised me a little bit because I thought it would trend a little bit younger. The potential audience is anyone who might want to work in soccer. And that is a very big number, I think. Who doesn't want to combine what they do as a career and the sport that they love? So we hear that all the time.
I forwarded the newsletter to a childhood friend who is a professional basketball player in Newcastle. I was back home. I heard from his mother. He wanted to work in the industry. I was like, you gotta read this newsletter. Yeah. I think you'll love it.
That's cool.
So I'm out here spreading the good word.
Thank you, sir.
of course. I think a lot of work goes into the newsletter, maybe not so much, but just in terms of doing the interview, cleaning up the transcript or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're sending it out. I know the cadence has changed a bit.
Yeah, we're every other week now.
Every other week right now. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. How much time are you putting into each issue?
So my brother and I typically split the interviews, right? You'll notice there's a pretty obvious, like, if it's off field, it's me. If it's on field, it's him. We err on the side of off field a little bit more than on field. Just there are more people who are interested in that. We did this year bring on a gentleman named Trey Higdon, who's got a long career in the sport as a, it's a bit of a side hustle for him. He works on it in the evenings and weekends, but he essentially helps get it prepped and ready. We didn't have that resource last year. We just did it, the three of us. Mm-hmm. I would say in an, you know, an average sort of cycle, I'm probably spending, you know, an hour to 90 minutes total. Maybe not including the interview, which is obviously normally about 20, 30 minutes. So it's not a ton of time. And
you probably don't have to prep so much for these interviews. Your depth of knowledge is so deep. It's like, it's kind of just like having a beer catching.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I do take a little pride in just trying to unearth a couple things, you know, trying to unearth as you've done a nice job in your research, right. But trying to unearth a couple things that maybe are off the beaten path. But I think that's right. It's, for me, it feels very comfortable. It's second nature. So the actual time commitment's not that significant. Nolan spends a little bit more. And then I'd say it's probably split, you know, by percentage. Trey's probably doing 50% of the work and Nolan and I doing about 25%, depending on the issue. So I have a particular voice for it. So I do a nice edit through the whole thing and just make sure the nuance is right. Right. It's not hard to get little things wrong and people sniff it out quickly in soccer. So but yeah, it's not a massive time investment. And I really enjoy doing it. And I mean, I enjoy the conversations. I enjoy putting together, as I said, it's sort of just stretching a different part of my brain, based on everything else I'm doing with the agency.
Okay. Let's talk about the name and number Crater Collective. My impression is that it is sort of an agency within the agency, or maybe not within, adjacent to, I don't know. I need you to tell me.
Yeah, I would say, we've done the hard work for the brands. So yeah. Soccer, I'd say creators in this country that are soccer specific. I'm not speaking to creators more broadly, creators in sports, soccer specific creators are like the fan base. It's fragmented and there's a lot of nuance and it has grown a lot the last few years, but navigating it is hard. If you were a brand and you just said, man, we really want to be in soccer, who are the creators we could connect to? It would be very difficult to try and figure that out. So we've spent the better part of 6 months identifying the creators that we've brought onto the collective, all of whom we've worked with before, which is really important to us. We're not just grabbing someone out of thin air and saying these guys have a big following. We've actually brought them into projects already.
So it's kind of like over the past 2 years running Name and Number, you start like a brand would be like, hey, we got to do this. And you're like, okay, we'll get distribution in this way by bringing in some creators. And then at a certain point, you're like, hey, we've gotten good at this.
Yeah.
Everyone wants it. What if we kind of made this its own offering?
Exactly right. And in some ways, it was the brand asking for it. But it actually, in most cases, it was us suggesting it and weaving it into existing projects. And I'll give you an example. We work with Bayer Leverkusen, who are the Bundesliga champions, best team in Germany over the course of the last, 18 months or so. They've won 3 trophies. They've had a ton of success in the field. They brought their trophies over to New York City last September. And the assignment was a trophy tour watch party event. One day in New York, we went to a German beer house. It was awesome. Had the trophies there, had their mascot, Brian the Lion, there. But there wasn't additional budget to do more than kind of run the event. And so we tapped into our creator relationships and brought 10 creators into the event. We booked a field sort of in between the two primary elements of the event and just let them play. We got them all vintage Leverkusen kits. So they're all wearing the brand, right? And it's like cool heritage soccer.
Those vintage Leverkusen, they're great. They're cool, you got the Alka-Seltzer logo, et cetera.
Those are great. Yeah. And that, that culture, that sort of the fashion footy culture is so prominent. So it wasn't a lot more than that. It was just, we just brought in people we had relationships with, gave them the freedom to create stuff that worked for their channels and their platforms, which I think is the most important thing in working with creators, is ensuring that whatever you do, there's a bridge between, obviously the brand has particular objectives, the club has particular objectives, but what is the creator's voice? What type of content do they produce? So we wanted to give them the freedom to create the type of content that they feel good about and comfortable with and that resonates with their audience. But that was an assignment where it was like, this is an experiential assignment. We brought in creators. And so the knock on and amplification effect of that over 1 million organic impressions across.
How do you amplify this time and place moment into something that becomes like a digital thing with potentially millions?
Yeah, that's right.
It.
Yeah. And it's all, all pointed towards trying to connect with American soccer fans. And, I can say more broadly is that everyone around the world who is invested in the sport of soccer or knows a little bit about soccer is trying to figure out what's their U.S. plan, what's their North America plan more broadly. And it's a difficult place to come into. We talk to brands and clubs around the world and everyone knows they need to be here because of not only because of the World Cup, just the growth and the opportunity in this country. And so certainly with the agency, that's part of what we're trying to do. And Creator Collective is another way to try to plug them into the existing soccer fan base here.
Yeah. Okay. I want to get into something else there, but real quick, I want to take a tangent on the fashion side of things, because I think as somebody who I consume a lot of soccer content, especially on Twitter and on Instagram reels, whether it's, you know, clips of games, et cetera, whatever. But I think that fashion aspect is a really big one. And that's something that goes far beyond sports fan culture, right? Like, I think it's become so trendy in the past 3 or 4 years, maybe really since the 2022 World Cup, I don't know, to see like vintage kits or like fashion brands doing their own kits. Balenciaga was doing like a series of kits recently. And I know one of your, I think, pretty sure this was in the deck you sent me, one of the biggest successes you guys have had with social media is this World Soccer Shop campaign, which was like an ASMR video of World Soccer Shop in their warehouse, like just like, you know, scratching all the different patches that you have to, like the Premier League patch, the Euro
official patches. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. That's a really interesting element that I hadn't thought of to talk about when I was prepping for this, but I think that's probably something you are leveraging, trying to find ways to leverage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the closest kind of approximation in sports is the NBA, which has, I think, kind of fashion culture woven through it in a way that, not that it isn't, but I think NFL, MLB, NHL, it's just less so. Soccer being the most global sport, you know, it is able to connect to fashion in a way that maybe other sports can't, certainly not in the same way. And you're seeing it across the clubs around the world. You mentioned the one collaboration, you know, Off-White. There's a bunch of examples.
With Milan,
just high fashion brands doing collaborations within the sport of soccer, but not just high fashion. I mean, I think, like, you know, there's a lot of collaborations happening even in the U.S. with, you know, sort of streetwear brands, skate shops. That stuff happens a lot in soccer. You know, just at the World Soccer Shop mention, you know, I have to shout out a woman on our team named Caitlin Stevens, who is a creator herself, is on our team full time, and has really been the driving force behind the Creator Collective, because she has the relationships. She knows the space really well. She creates herself. She has been working with World Soccer Shop for a number of years, and it's a really good example for how the Creator Collective can work. That engagement is sort of twofold. One is we have sort of a content studio where we produce content that's just of the jerseys, and it's showing off the highlights and the little elements of the jerseys. But then we have three creators who are on year-long engagements that are that they produce content on a monthly basis. So it varies, right? It could be one piece of content a month for some of our bigger creators. It could be 3 to 5 pieces of content a month for some of the smaller creators. But I think what's really interesting about it and important, one is it gives the brand the opportunity to have consistent content. They know what's coming. We're working with them, obviously, on what type of content, what's the topic, what are the clubs we're featuring. But then for the creator, you know, if you're a solo creator or you're being a creator as a side hustle, is having some consistent income happening over a course of a year is a big deal, even if that's not like a
that's hard know, to secure.
It's hard. And so as we a lot of the collective comes out of having those conversations with creators and saying, man, I had this month where, you know, I made 50 grand and then I had 3 months where I didn't make anything. And so it's like that, you know, that ebb and flow is difficult. I don't know if we'll be able to solve that for all of the creators, but certainly one of our objectives is to both find some creative, some consistent income, and then obviously solve creative problems for the clients who all have to feed the beast of social and are looking for interesting ways to do it.
Well, so another thing I want to ask about here is looking at your roster of creators. I know some of them have representation and some of them don't, which goes back to that mix of, you know, the grassroots, the Central American midfielder who's going to go to the Premier League, et cetera. What is the business model there? Like, how do you... I mean, I'm interested not just in the clients, but in you and what flows to you, what flows to the creator, what flows to their management, where the brand is the client. How does this get split and how do you price these things? Is it based on view, on reach? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be upfront and say there's a little bit of exploration on how it's going to work, I think. And I do think it will evolve as we go. What we've established with those who have representation is essentially, and this is where sort of the hard work has come in over multiple months, right? Conversations with agents, conversations with the creators, understanding their priorities and where they have challenges and, you know, sort of what they're trying to do over the course of the next, multiple years. But really, we're talking about the next 18 months as you head into the World Cup. We all acknowledge and understand that's the opportunity. So we have a sort of a master services agreement with the agents and the creator, the agency and the creator. which sort of establishes some of the ground rules. Importantly for us is we just sort of want to inject ourselves into the relationship between the agency and the creator. We're not mm-hmm. interested in being agents. We want to be a facilitator. And so, as I said earlier,
you're a layer between brands and creators.
Yeah. So we're already working with the brands, right? We're already working with the clubs. And for creators, I think that's the hardest part often, even sometimes with agencies. And, you know, there aren't any soccer specific agencies that represent creators, right? These creators are working with certainly folks who know the soccer industry, and it's not to diminish what they know and their relationships, but they're doing other things. They're doing broadcasts. We talked to one creator whose agent was, it was the only soccer creator she had. She worked in food. And so she had 10 other people mm-hmm. on her roster, but they're all in like the food and restaurant business. And, you know, she's great at her job. She's helping this creator be successful. But again, I think it kind of comes back to if we're the soccer specialists, if we know the sport better than most, I say that with no ego, but we do. We've got great people who know and understand the sport.
American soccer is number 10.
American soccer is number 10. Thank you, Francis. I think that's the third mention. Appreciate it.
It's a great line. I love it. That's why it's burned in my brain.
Shout out Tim Whitney on the team who wrote that copy for our new biz deck. Is we're the conduit, we're the facilitator. I mean, truly the number 10 is the representative thing, right? We sit in the middle of the field.
Yeah.
We're the connector, we're the playmaker, we're bringing in the right midfielder, we're pinging the ball over the top to the forward. And so just to come back to the structure of it is we have established rate cards. We sort of know their starting point. Obviously, that's always flexible. It's always negotiated, but we're not injecting ourselves into that relationship between the agent and the creator. That sort of sits separate. Whatever their arrangement is, great. Where I think the value comes for us is we've now negotiated these deals across 5 different agencies, 12 different creators. There's no work for the brand to do there. They come to us and we can provide them with sort of a suite of options depending on what they want to do, who they want to connect with, and make it really turnkey. And ideally for us, you know, I think we want to add a layer of what a strategic consultation look like beyond creators, right? As opposed to just going to one creator and saying, hey, could you give me 4 posts for 10 grand? It's, you want to connect to soccer fans? This is one way to do it. Let us help advise you on how else you can do it, whether that's, you know, owned and organic, whether that's paid, whether that's a partnership with someone in the sport. Yeah. There's a lot of different ways to connect to soccer fans, as you know. So, we've got 3 existing clients who are, it might be 4, who are already connected into our creators. Now we'll start the process of, as we make the announcement next week, as we're recording, we'll go out next Wednesday, and we'll see. We'll see sort of what comes in. We'll obviously, it'll become a part of our new business pitch, and we'll just have it as another tool in the toolbox for fans, for brands to connect with American soccer fans.
Yeah. One thing, American soccer fans, speaking of that, I want to get into the American-European divide that you've kind of touched on a lot here and how it's so fragmented here, how in Europe, you haven't said this explicitly, but implying that in Europe it's less fragmented. And I think of my own consumption of soccer content and soccer creators, and it's because I follow the English Premier League and Bundesliga, et cetera. So much of the content I see is these European creators. Like I think of a couple German and British people who I get so much of their content. Is there anything you have learned from how this works in Europe? Are there not necessarily partners, but peers you've spoken to learn how to take something about the landscape there over here?
That's an interesting question. You know, the answer is not really. We are obviously in tune with what's happening abroad. But our focus really is exclusively on it's kind of a bit blinders on as we're focused on American soccer. And so I think there are certainly lessons to be taken from Europe, which is just more advanced, right, in terms of its soccer fandom, its football fandom.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say now as you ask a question, I'm like, maybe we should be spending more time looking at what creators are doing in Europe. Thanks, Francis. But it's obviously bigger over there. It's on a completely different scale and level. And right or wrong, I would say we're so in tune with what's happening here in the U.S. and sort of what it takes to be successful in the U.S. that that's really been our focus.
Yeah. So I want to pivot away from the soccer bit and go back into your career to the NASCAR years. So you were at NASCAR 2013, 2014, 2015, 3 full years, and you had switched from DC United, where you were in some head of marketing role. Mm-hmm. And then here you were really focused on social media. And that's a really interesting time to have been working in social media. I think I got my Instagram account in 2014. Yeah.
You and NASCAR social media, both.
Yeah. Yes. Well, exactly. And so that's what I want to ask about. Very different time from now, and kind of a time when all these norms were being forged. I'm sure you did a lot then that you don't do now, but I'm sure there's also a lot that you learned and had to figure out that you still lean on. So tell me about that time and some of the challenges you had to deal with and some of what you still have taken from then that's in use today.
Yeah, that was it was people always sort of chuckle when I tell them I worked at NASCAR because it's just so markedly different than soccer in this country, right? Yeah. It's largely an older fan base. It's a big fan base. I mean, one of the things I learned was that NASCAR is a big business and they got a lot of
passionate
fans. Oh, man. People don't really understand. I think NASCAR has a lot of kind of preconceived notions about what it is and who the fan base is. And not all of them are false, but the reality when you're in it is you realize how big and significant the sport is and how big the driver. I mean, the drivers are stars. I was working with Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson and Kevin Harvick. And these guys had massive followings. And the thing that was really enjoyable and I mean, I learned so much from that entire experience, but they were really plugged into their fans. They knew their fan bases better than any athletes I'd worked with previously. And I don't know if that's still the case. I would assume that it is. But they were active on social. They were engaged. They wanted to learn. At that time, as you said, 13, 14, 15, you know, Twitter was obviously significant. Facebook was probably a bigger player. Not probably. It was a bigger player than it is now.
I was on Facebook a lot back then. I haven't really touched it for like 6 years now.
I think that's, you know, behavior's changed a lot, right, in the last 10 years. And so Instagram was coming on, but like literally drivers were joining Instagram during that time. I brought NASCAR onto the platform for the first time. We launched on Instagram. I remember getting there and going like, how are you guys not on Instagram? Like, it's already big enough that you should be on it.
Yeah.
So it's just a totally different time. But, you know, as someone who didn't know the sport, I was not a NASCAR guy. I told him in my interview, I'd never watched a NASCAR race in full. So if you want someone who understands what this is, do not hire me. But if you want someone who's going to bring in different ideas, I'd love the challenge.
Which is why you went to also gain different ideas for yourself to bring back to soccer later.
I didn't tell them that in the interview, but the idea was always, what can I learn from a different industry?
You gave them 3 years. Yeah, that's a long time.
It would have been longer, but the Seattle Sounders came calling a little bit unexpectedly. But I did it really intentionally. At that time, I actually had, again, said with no ego, I just had other opportunities. I had an opportunity with the New York Rangers. I could have gone to another MLS team, or I could have gone to the NWSL League at that time. All just had sort of opportunities with that window. And I chose NASCAR because I felt like it would provide me with the most different and disparate experience from my own. And and again, it was big business. You think about the Fortune 500, Fortune 100 brands that are in the sport. I mean, I was in the room as a, whatever I was at the time, you know, 32, 33-year-old kid, you know, with 3M, with Ford, with Toyota, with Coca-Cola, just exposure I wouldn't have otherwise gotten. And so for me, it added a layer, I think, of like polish and a depth of business understanding that I didn't have coming from what was, you know, in DC United was a big and successful club by MLS standards, but not by NASCAR standards.
Well, and MLS was, as a league, was much smaller, probably much less money flowing into it.
Totally.
At that time, you might not have been having these conversations with brands this big for deals this big if you were still at MLS at that time.
No question. And I think, you know, while the platforms have changed, the algorithms have changed, the fundamentals, I don't think, have changed all that much, right? It's still connection. It's still community building. It's still entertainment. It's still education. It's still, you know, it's still how do you build interest and connectivity across a group of humans that, you know, either want to be entertained or want some sort of connection. And so those fundamentals
changes, the goal doesn't.
I think that's right. Right. And so the fundamentals haven't changed. Well, perhaps the platforms and the algorithms have.
Outside of NASCAR, back to soccer, are there any clubs or players that you think are doing social media or creator driven work really well right now?
Yeah, it's hard to pick one. There's so many that are doing well. I mean, certainly you've seen the investment, I think, over the last 5 years in particular, really come into sports broadly, but soccer as well. You know, people always point to, and I think appropriately so, I know it's your club, but I'll say it anyway, Arsenal does an incredible job with their with their content. I think it's really elevated. It's diverse. You know, they seem to really focus on platform-specific content production, right? It's not just kind of spray and pray. I think they really do a nice job of creating content for the channel, for the platform.
One I'll hand you, one of your own clients, Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah.
I think they do a great job on their Instagram. They are creating like Instagram native, you know, meme format type of content that feels timely and feels like really polished to the level that a professional club should be, but still with a bit of that raw edge that social media content should have. I really admire what they do.
No, I totally agree with you. Sport 5 runs their social accounts, I believe. Still, they're a big, you know, international
agency.
They work really closely with the club, but a lot of the clubs have hired agencies to do their international channels, you know, whether that's a U.S. focused or an English language channel. certainly as the sport grows more broadly, you're seeing, you know, Chinese language channels, Indian channels, you know, Portuguese trying to tackle Brazil. So there are a number of agencies that are managing club accounts these days. And Sport 5 does a great job with Dortmund. They certainly have – I think they've pushed the boundaries of what you'd expect from a professional team, to your point. It's like it's a lot of meme content. I'm old enough now where I feel like I used to be plugged in everything. I see stuff. I'm like, I honestly have no idea where that came from. I have to go search for it. That's a little bit embarrassing. But, yeah, Borussia Dortmund does a great job. And then on the player side, I'm a big fan generally of Trinity Rodman, who's with the Washington Spirit, U.S. Women's National Team. She's, you know, not like often active, but when she's on, whether TikTok or Instagram, just the personality that comes out, you feel like, you know, it's one of those, it feels like it could be your friend's account. And I think for players to be accessible, to show warmth, to show their personality is still, again, fundamental, but, a lot of players don't do it. I think she does a great job.
Yeah. One person I talked to last year in the soccer football world, not this guy, but are you familiar with the UK football creator John Nellis?
I've heard the name. I can't say I've followed.
Yeah, big YouTuber. I think they're around 3 million followers right now, but at the beginning of last year, it was like 650,000. They've grown a lot. Wow. I spoke to his YouTube strategist, this guy, Alex Emery. And one thing that really stuck with me that he said is how they went to the Euros and they got, I forget the exact numbers, some millions of views that was more total than like BBC, Sky, DAZN, a number of like traditional broadcasters, their short form, their social media content didn't hold a candle to the engagement that John's got. And he was trying to make a point about the power that creators have relative to broadcasters, though of course broadcasters still have the license for the games.
Yeah.
And John couldn't show
the highlights. Yeah.
Exactly. But what he could do is like come up with these concepts of like, oh, you know, there's a deposit on the cups. If you bring them back, you get a euro or whatever it was. So I'm going to see how many I can collect and have this massive tower and get millions of views doing that. So I'm interested. If you have any thoughts on the relationship and like, I don't know if power dynamics is the right way to frame it, but between these rising creators and the traditional broadcasters.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it all eventually overlaps, doesn't it? It's sort of funny how it happens. And so another example, you know, iShowSpeed, who
just
obviously,
a couple weeks
you
ago.
Know,
yeah.
Very, very big creator, you know, has a particular style and personality that many love. You know, he's now on Paramount Plus's Champions League coverage with some frequency over the course of the last couple of weeks. And
which seemed, I watched live when he was on, and then the previous week when he was kind of brought up as a joke. And I honestly can't tell if that was intentional or kind of casual. And then the producers pivoted and like, let's actually get him on next week.
Yeah.
I could not tell if
I don't know either. I know a couple of people over there. I'll ping them after and ask. Yeah, you could see it being a setup, right? It's like, well, hey, we know we've got iShowSpeed coming next week. Let's talk about it this week. But you know, you know, you saw the Sidemen match that happened at Wembley, right? Sold out, raised 5 million plus. And you know, the highlights out of that, which is not professional soccer players playing soccer, but massive creators, influencer personality.
What was the score? 8-8-8 at the end.
Yeah. I don't even know. Yeah, ridiculous. But, you know, speed, you know, assisting on a goal had millions of views. So, you know,
it was Adidas' biggest, most views ever on one of their videos.
I think that's right. Yeah. Right. And you're seeing, you know, we had Caitlin, who I mentioned earlier, who's on our team, who's a creator, was at a couple different events in Atlanta. Creators are just they're. Again, creators who have influence, I mean, they're being invited to these events, being woven into them. Yeah. And I think it's interesting when you see the collision of someone who's maybe traditionally on a TikTok or an Instagram or YouTube, and now they're being pulled into the kind of bigger broadcast channels. And, you know, they're seeing the benefit of, I mean, if you go and look and do a quick scroll through Paramount Plus, their handle is CBS Sports Galazzo, and you look at the speed content, it is the most viewed and most engaged stuff that they've done, with probably the exception of a couple of the, you know, biggest goals and highlights. But
well, let's say too, like with speed. So he, you know, when he was 17 or whatever, he's streaming, and then maybe this is only 3 years. I think he's like 20 now. So it was like 3 years ago he's streaming and somebody donates like £1.79 and he says like Cristiano Ronaldo suey. And then that's like, I watched this great, like 15 minute YouTube video the other day, like kind of charting his rise. And then now he becomes this like huge global fan base. And it was the way this video I watched framed it is like, once he starts doing that and becomes this Ronaldo super fan is when he starts really reaching the international audience. And then he's going on tour to like through South America, through Southeast Asia. And there's these rabid fan bases where it's like he actually has to really plan in advance to not like shut a city down because there's so many people. And that's like a global audience thing, which then brings it back to this is an American creator, but he is engaging with audiences because of European football. He's engaging with global audiences, and there's this disconnect where like how do you get him being like a Pulisic super fan or whatever it is, he's from Ohio, being a Columbus Crew super fan and like promoting that. There's this thing where like this is this massive powerful force, but it's connected again to the global game, not the US game.
Well, you're speaking to the challenge that exists in the US broadly, right? Which is, I say all the time is, you know, you could be in Atlanta and not care at all about Atlanta United, even though they draw 50,000-60,000 fans.
It's like one of the second biggest.
When they open the full building, you know, they couldn't do it probably 17 times a year, but a couple times a year they'll open the full building. It'll be, you know, top three in the attendance in the world. To your point, so, but you know, you've got this weird reality in the U.S. where you could have someone in Atlanta who isn't an Atlanta United fan, loves Arsenal, and will get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch an Arsenal game, but won't go across the street to see a game at Mercedes-Benz because they see the product is inferior. But at the same time, you could have a friend who loves Atlanta United, is a season ticket holder, and loves PSG, but by the way, also loves Man United for whatever reason, right? Those connections are not always clear.
Ibrahimovic guy.
Anyways. Totally, exactly. Yes, but you're speaking to that nuance even through the lens of speed, which is my approach is always, my perspective has always been, we can't really worry about it. You're not going to win over every European soccer fan, right? The phrase that gets used in MLS historically is Euro snob. It's like some people have just decided, and that's okay. Like they've just decided, I want to watch the best in the world. Fine, that's Premier League. It just is, right? Bundesliga, La Liga, Serie A, all very, very good. MLS isn't that, but MLS can be valuable. The experience is great. The community is here. There's a lot of reasons why MLS has value if you're okay with it not being the best in the world. And a lot of American sports fans aren't. But I think as we've seen the growth of MLS specifically, and to a lesser extent NWSL, is there are a lot of people who are now hardcore and avid MLS fans, and you're seeing that growth happen. And I'll say one other thing, Francis, which is one of the things I didn't anticipate when I started my career in the sport 20 plus years ago was the growth in the small and mid-sized markets. And as we record this, a very funny thing happened yesterday where Ronaldinho, one of the most famous players in history, was in Greenville, South Carolina with the Greenville Triumph. I think he's maybe a part owner or something, but I found it to be just the most hilarious thing is here's Ronaldinho, absolute legend, walking down the field to watch Greenville Triumph, which is part of United Soccer League. But that sort of stuff is happening. So this the growth of the sport isn't just in the New Yorks and the LAs and the Miamis. It's happening across small and mid-sized markets across the country. And what I don't think people anticipate about the 26th World Cup is the host cities, of course, will be bumping and there'll be activities. Yeah. I think every major, mid, and small market is going to do something around the World Cup in 2026. And it's just going to be across the entirety of the country. And people are undervaluing how that will take place in some of the markets that aren't hosting games. I think it's going to be significant. You know, you think about the World Cup, it's the biggest sporting event in human history, right? It's expanding the number of teams. It's the first time three nations have hosted. It's the most games ever played. I don't know if you're aware, Francis, but the most attended World Cup to date of all time is which one? Do you know?
It is the 1994 U.S. World Cup.
It is the 1994 U.S. World Cup. Despite, you know, the growth of the game happening a lot since then, we got big stadiums here. And so now you're going to have significantly more games. I mean,
we love spectacle.
We do love spectacle. We love a show. And again, best in the world. It's like the Olympics. You think you're actually not in many cases. You're missing some of the best players in the world, truly. But
at the Olympics,
for the most part. No, even at the World Cup, right? It's there are great players whose national teams aren't very good.
Erling Haaland wasn't at the last World Cup.
Exactly. So, you know, when you see New Zealand play Portugal, like that's not the best team in the world, right?
But, no shade to Chris Wood.
No shade to Chris Wood. Good shout. So in the 94 World Cup, 3.4 million people attended that. It probably will be in excess of 7 million for the 2026 World Cup because they're playing – more venues, more games, and obviously the stadiums here are massive. So again, not to belabor the point, but it's going to be a massive, massive event and will, I think, take over the country for the better part of 4 or 5 weeks.
I mean, the last World Cup I alone am proof that, like, you know, I now spend hours every week either watching a game, reading articles on The Athletic, you know, scrolling through Instagram. I will admit I've done some sports betting. I've, you know, bought many beers at bars to watch games. I've been to games in Germany. I've, you know, been to, et cetera. That World Cup alone has, like, spurred me as, like, probably putting, I don't know, maybe a couple thousand dollars into soccer related things.
Probably at least,
into,
right?
Into bars because of soccer, et cetera. So,
well,
multiply that by millions.
To bring it back to, you know, some of your early questions about why did I launch the agency, why I launched Pathways, you're describing it, which is, for us, the World Cup is not a destination. It's an accelerator for the sport that we love, right? Ultimately, I'm going to hopefully look back on a long career in the sport and be really proud of helping, you know, playing a very small role, but helping it to grow. And so a lot of brands and agencies are kind of dropping into the sport now, because of the World Cup. But for us, we just see it as an accelerator. And so all the new fans are going to come out of it. They're younger, they're tech savvy, they're digital. Brands are going to want to connect to those folks. And we're over here saying, hello, we can help.
Yeah. I actually do have one last question for the creator audience. As somebody who has worked in social media, run social media accounts for these big brands, and now working with creators on behalf of brands, I guess if you have advice for both creators and brands who want to work with them on how to achieve really successful partnerships.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways to answer that. I think what comes to mind is that I'm still amazed to see big brands, Fortune 500 companies, who are working with top tier athletes in the U.S. There's an example in my head. I won't name names, but big financial services brand working with a U.S. women's national team player recently, and she's reading off a script, right, with someone holding the phone, and it's just it's so bland, it's so boring, and so it's just, you know, the word gets way overused, but authenticity is just so important, and allowing the creator the freedom in the room to, like, you've got to give them a little bit of space to do what they do because they know their audience, they know the channel. It's the reason to hire them. And when you bring in a creator and then you put them in this box where there's no expression, there's no connection to what they typically do, I actually think it's worse than even doing anything, right? It's like, let them do what they do. And like, there's always going to be a little massaging to that, right? It's like the brand, obviously there's a talking point, there's a product, there's something that they want to bring to the fore, but it's really the marriage of those two things. Is can you do that in a way that's authentic? And I'll give you one example that I didn't come to mind earlier, but is a good one, is Moss by Messi. It's his new sports drink.
Yeah.
They have plugged into the creator community a lot over the last several weeks, including folks who are in the collective, but we aren't yet benefiting from it because we haven't launched the collective. But they've done a really good job of, like, you know, saying, hey, here's the drink. It's Messi, which helps, right? Because everybody loves Messi. Except for Speed and Ronaldo fans. But, you know, like, go create the type of content that you typically create. And so it's a good kind of marriage of the two things. So I would say, you know, for the creators, there's a reality to, you know, you need to find revenue. It's find the right ways to push and show yourself as the expert, right? And there's always going to be a point where, you know, when you've probably pushed too much on a brand, but, you know, It only works. The results are only going to be good if you can find the right combination of what the brand needs and what you are good at doing.
Well, I think actually to bring this back to Speed going on CBS, it's like, to me, not that I saw so many think pieces about this, but I saw like some people talking about it on Twitter and like it's not surprising or weird at all because this is somebody who has the eyeballs of millions on him. So why would you not bring him in to try to do his thing? And they let him do his thing in a very normal way. Let's do this race where he's racing Jamie Carragher kind of in the back halls behind the scenes of CBS and he like rips his pants and it's so chaotic and all this. And
he does
like,
a backflip off the desk, right?
Exactly. Just bring him in, let him do his thing. And maybe, you know, a few of the members of his audience will enjoy the banter between Kate Scott and Thierry Henry and Jamie Carragher and Micah Richards and then pay the $10 a month or whatever it is for a CBS subscription.
Yeah, right. I think that's exactly right.
That.
Well, the last point I'll make just to your question is, you know, for brands, I think it's just the sort of the opposite side of it, which is trust creators. I think trust that they know what they're doing, understand where you need to set the parameters and be clear about kind of that key objective, whatever it is you're trying to achieve, but then allow the creator the freedom to create and connect with their audience in the way that they know how. That's the reason you do it. And obviously from our perspective, our hope is that we can kind of sit in that in-between seat and be the translator and help them come together in a way that's beneficial for both.
Period. Kyle, thank you for coming on. Where should people go to find your stuff?
Yeah, name and number, nameandnumber.com. We're name and number spelled out on primary social channels. Pathway_HQ on social. And then you can find us on Beehive with our Pathway newsletter as well. And then I'm just at Kyle Sheldon across most channels. So please say hello and connect. Love connecting with folks in the community.
Perfect. And listener, I will see you next week. Thank you.